If you're here to hear about rhetoric, the formidable discipline, you're in the right place. If you're not here to hear that, I dare you to stand up and show that you made a mistake. If you're following the outline, you'll see in my synopsis that I have particularly opinionated observations about what I've observed in rhetoric. I've been involved in classical Christian education now for about 17 years, and while that doesn't qualify me as an expert, the fact that I also live out of town does. Let me read this synopsis that I've written to introduce this talk. Most students who've passed a rhetoric course are little better for it as rhetoricians. The question is, why is that? Because most of what's taught is the grammar of rhetoric. What will it take to make a classically educated kid a knock-em-dead rhetorician? I think we'd better learn that soon. As I got involved in classical Christian education, my motivation was I was thrilled with what I thought it could be. But I had the delightful luxury at that point of having my oldest child be a rising second grader, and rhetoric was far enough off in the curriculum that I didn't need to understand it then the way I should now as it related to my own family. And I had the opportunity to do some promotional speaking in school contexts and that sort of thing about classical Christian education. And I want to talk a little bit about some of my early thoughts about rhetoric as I would talk about the trivium and that sort of thing. And you'll see in here that the first note I make, and I think it's an important one to note, that of my early thoughts, they were not many. As I would talk about the trivium and help people like you before you might have been exposed to classical Christian education to become familiar with what we meant by this pedagogical model, quite as hard as rhetoric. But now, having watched the systems of your schools develop and the curricular things and the accomplishments of our students develop, I think that we have this as at least one of our great hurdles to overcome to be what I think we ought to be, and that is to make knock-em-dead rhetoricians. It was easy for me to see that expressing oneself was an important issue in the process. But when we talk about that, and even curricularly, when we see it in how it's carried out, my rhetoric education was a speech class in college. That was it. And that's, if we understand rhetoric to be a speech class, we've missed a lot. And I hope to open up your eyes a little bit and start a deeper conversation among us about this as we move through this hour. But to think of it as a capstone, as communication, as a capstone of a classical Christian education, quite honestly, was a hard thing for me to swallow. And have you experienced that? Okay, that was the only one. I'm sorry. You're lying. But now let me talk a little bit about what some of my current thoughts are, and try and get you thinking in these categories. It's actually now much easier, in fact, downright easy, to see it as a capstone. Let me back up a little bit. It's easy to see the benefits of the grammar stage, content mastery. That's an easy thing to see. But yeah, when we think in terms of getting the data down and the benefits of that, we can see that. When we think about basic language mastery, you know, we can see that. We can understand that. We think of the benefits of mastery of logic and being able to think through things and think clearly and not make mistakes and not be drawn in to bad ideas or bad beliefs and the benefits of logic. Those are important. But I'm concerned that we frequently get it wrong when it comes to rhetoric. And it's actually fairly simple. I alluded to it in my synopsis, and I'll cover this again. It's basically this that I'm trying to point out. Most rhetoric is teaching about rhetoric, and not teaching rhetorical mastery. Okay, that's what I'm saying, pure and simple. Many students graduate from classical Christian schools without developing as rhetoricians. I could introduce you to students who got A's and B's in rhetoric, who still won't look you in the eye when they talk, who still will be fairly limited in their ability to articulate an idea or communicate effectively and thoroughly. Now, I think we need to realize there's a lot of popularity with the term progymnasmat or short progym, and I think it's a wonderful thing in terms of what it does for developing writers. But I think sometimes we get a little bit of an overemphasis there because the progymnasmata is a form of training wheels. It's an early stage aspect of rhetoric rather than a completion of it. Now I may raise the hairs on the back of your neck a little bit there because I'm not going to continue that any further to justify the statement. I'll be happy to do that privately, but I want to move into it. But the point is that it's a beginning help, not a process that's going to be any more valuable than early stage training in the context of developing effective rhetoricians. The other thing we need to realize as we think in terms of the importance of this and trying to get it down solid is that every situation is a rhetorical situation. Every situation has something to do with our comportment, how we carry ourselves, how we communicate, how we articulate. As I stand here talking to you, as I have done in any number of times previously, I'm going to be drawn to some of you more than others because you're going to respond in ways with your facial expression, with the nodding of your head, with your puzzled looks, with all those kinds of things that are going to make your behavior a rhetorical situation for you. Now, I'm not trying to make you self-conscious, and I'll try very desperately to scan the audience now rather than focus on any one of you. But you're laughing. You're moving. So I lied. I did focus on somebody. And the point is that every situation is a rhetorical one. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, it depends. Depends what we're trying to do. There are some people who have simply figured out how to be the center of attention because that's what gets their juices going. Well, I can relate to that. I've been guilty of that. Maybe you have too. That's not a good motivation. But there are times where you should be the center of attention. If some of you picked up your chairs and turned them into that corner, I would get a little disturbed at the moment. I would find that to be a statement of a nonverbal statement that would communicate a lot. At this point, I am in some sense the center of your attention, and I should be. So we need to understand the circumstance. We need to understand the context of those things. The point, though, is that every circumstance that we find ourselves is a rhetorical situation. What we're communicating and how we're communicating always matters. Now let's move into the next part of the outline here. Mastering rhetoric is either very hard work or comes naturally. There is no discipline that benefits the gifted more than rhetoric that I know of. There are some people that are inclined to math. They're going to find algebra to be a breeze. And there are some kids who just, when they learn to read a lot faster than their sibling or their classmate who went through the same steps to learn to read. Giftedness. But the aspect of giftedness with regard to rhetoric is more significant than any of those disciplines in my observation. And that merits serious consideration in a school setting when we're moving students as groups and as individuals, as opposed to other educational settings that might be dealing with students entirely in an individual context. So let's talk about the hard work category for just a moment. We're going to have to expect a student who finds it to be hard work to be asked to do actions that are contrary to their personality and comfort zone. If I were to ask you the question, how many of you find it difficult to do public speaking as an example of rhetoric, I would be putting you in an uncomfortable position twice. Once by the admission, the other one by actually admitting it in front of the rest of you. But if I were to ask the question in a positive way, how many of you enjoy that process, your hands would go up and wave. I'm illustrating the point. It's hard when it's hard and it's easy when it's easy. And we need to recognize that. And that's an important aspect as we address classes or groups of students in this process seeking greatest success for all of them. A student has to learn to be quick on his feet. How do you teach that? How do you teach somebody to marshal everything that they've learned into a responsive environment? I don't know how to do that. We can eat away at it, but how do we knock it down cold, doing it completely and solidly? I don't know. And therein lies a problem. If we're supposed to do something that we don't know how to do, the problem is obvious. And we've got to be ready, willing, and able to tackle it. We've got to address that. We've got to think strategically. This term in rhetorical categories is called invention. And it's a difficult thing to master. How do we do that? Now, the one thing that gives me a lot of hope in this process is that as I look at people who were really classically educated in many respects, there were some of them who were a lot better than most of us. I'm continually and routinely impressed when I take a glance back at Dorothy Sayers' essay with something of the rhetorical nature of it. In addition to the content, in addition to what's communicated, just look at how she turns phrases and communicates in such interesting and clever ways. A moment ago, I was watching somebody reading a Dickens book, and we were just talking about Dickens as a writer. You know, a lot of the books that he wrote had a very similar thread to them. Poor Boy Meets Girl in 19th century England. But when you look at, and so his diversity of what he wrote, and somebody that's a big Dickens fan might want to clobber me over the head with it, and you can do that. I've been clobbered over the head by the others too. But what he did so well was articulate in ways that just capture your imagination. And I think that's a lot of the genius of his writing. Look at these people. How did they do that? What did they do? What was their lifestyle? What was their education that caused them to be categorically and qualitatively better than us? Well, their survivability is part of it, and so they might be to their day what the great ones are to our day. But that's not all of it, because you can also look at the 19th century common foot soldier in the war between the states, or I guess maybe in this context, the War of Northern Aggression, and see that the letters to their wives or to their mothers had a flair and an articulation about them that just doesn't show up on our blogs and emails. It doesn't. Now, I'm not faulting blogs and emails. There are reasons to communicate in certain ways in certain contexts. But what I am saying is that there has been a qualitative deterioration, and it's not just because we don't cover the grammar stage well or the logic stage well. It's also because we don't cover the rhetoric stage well, and that's what I'm getting at and wanting us to just up the ante of the conversation. Now, those for whom it comes naturally tend to be people where their personality is gregarious. They're outgoing people, and they just love to communicate. I can introduce you to people who are so out of touch, you may think I'm one of them, that they'll communicate even when people don't want them to. There is an extreme there, too. But the people who are naturally inclined to be communicators tend to be people with those personality types. They tend to be bold people, and that's a great advantage in the mastery of rhetoric, because they don't have some of the natural abilities to do those kinds of things. It has to do with things like fear of failure and being realistic about that. We've heard all kinds of people in the late 20th century talking about how you do public speaking and imagining things about your audience that they, I don't know if I should say this in this context, but that they don't have any clothes on, or that they owe you money, or things like that. And playing games in ways that make you feel like you're safe and you're okay. But the bold person doesn't think that way. They operate with a level of confidence that may or may not be justified. Nevertheless, they operate with it. Some people are quicker on their feet than others. They love the idea of being challenged to think and operate extemporaneously. Some of us hate that idea. But the point is that people that are comfortable with that tend to be more gifted and more inclined to be more effective rhetoricians. They tend to have great recall ability. Most of you probably know the name R.C. Sproul. When we lived in Orlando, had the pleasure of being close to him and playing golf with him and that sort of thing. And one of the things, there are two things that I think that have contributed at a personal and gifted level to his success as a writer and rhetorician. One of them is his ability to take a complex idea and communicate it in language that we common folk can understand. And the other one is his recall ability. His mind hasn't aged the way my mind has aged. He remembers things in ways that are an evidence of incredible giftedness. And that's an important part of the natural rhetorician's giftedness. I think there's also an element of things being caught and not taught. Let's look at entrepreneurship for a minute. If you are paying attention to college curricula around the country, and especially in the business schools, you've seen in the last 5 to 10 years a creeping into that curriculum of an entrepreneurial emphasis, or an entrepreneurship emphasis, or an entrepreneurship major in many schools. And I've watched this happen, and I've developed some thinking about it, and one of the things that I think is that there's only so far that the book process can go in teaching entrepreneurship. A lot of it is simply caught. It happens at the dinner table. And in what you do at 9 o'clock before you go to bed, and those kinds of categories with your kids. And so the person most likely to be an entrepreneur is probably the child of an entrepreneur. It's not something that you're going to make out of it. I've seen people with all the giftedness in the world to do something of an entrepreneurial nature. But if they had to face, in the business world, the idea of making payroll after payroll every 2 weeks or however often they did in their business, they would never sleep and they would die from it for the simple reason that they're not cut out to do that. And you just can't teach that. So there's an element that is true in rhetoric, just like that of entrepreneurship, that we need to recognize that there's a giftedness separation. Nevertheless, we have students in various categories, and it is our goal, it ought to be our goal, it is our job, to make them as good as they can be. Make them as good a rhetorician as they can be. Not everybody needs to be able to write books or to lecture or to teach, but everybody needs to be able to communicate in some form at some time, and making them as good as possible according to the giftedness that they have by God is something that we need to do. We have, in the context of that point on the outline, there are a couple things I'll just mention very quickly. There's a sense of timing concern, there's a sense of objection, and there's a sense of feasibility. These kinds of things need to be appreciated in the process. There are things that we could spend hours on in and of themselves. You know, when is it right to say something or to do something? Context and timing. When is it right to object? I would think, if you object to something that I'm saying now, now is not the time for you to object openly and verbally. But there is an appropriate time for doing that, and there's an appropriate context for doing that. And knowing those things and executing those things is something that sometimes comes naturally to people and sometimes has to be learned. A sense of feasibility. Is something accomplishable? Is it realistic? Those are things that giftedness tends to have a sense of sometimes. But those are things that can also be taught and need to be thought through. In the context, again, of quicker on the feet than others, there's this element called kairos, or striking while the iron is hot, opportunity and advantageous timing. Those are important things. We are a culture who wants it quick, easy, and now. And that can be problematic when it comes to being effective. So this striking while the iron's hot has a corollary, and that is knowing when the iron is not hot. And that's an important part of the process. So I hope I've painted the picture a little bit to get to the point now of saying that teaching rhetoric requires more than we think it does at initial glance. It's not just public speaking. It's not just some simple understanding of communication. Every situation is a rhetorical situation. Of course, as we understand education and the learning of something, we have a pedagogy that we can apply to this. And there are going to be basics that are naturally included. So we have three modes of persuasion that we need to consider. And this is sometimes all that rhetoric ever gets in a classical Christian education. And I'm suggesting this is important, but it's baseline importance. It's not completion importance. There's more to it, but here's where we start. So we have logos, the words we use. We have pathos, the emotions we express or invoke. And ethos, character, ethical proof, personality. We've got to understand these things. We've got to understand that these are critical ingredients. We've got to learn how to do them. We've got to be able to teach how to do them. We've got to be able to control them. They need to be communicated. There's a great example of this in what is sometimes called the Great Debate. Now, if you Google the Great Debate, you'll get this, but you'll also get some other things. The Great Debate that I'm referring to is Kennedy-Nixon on September 26, 1960. Presidential election, television, first time this type of thing was happening. Nixon was credited with having won the debate on the radio. Kennedy on television. What would have caused that difference? Kennedy understood the rhetoric effectiveness of television. Nixon didn't. Nixon was articulate, persuasive. I assume by virtue of the fact that he was credited with having won the radio listeners' debate aspect, that his words were better. Kennedy wasn't afraid to use makeup to look better. I need to, you know, in this context, you got to be careful about how you talk about men wearing makeup, don't you? He wasn't afraid to look in the camera. He knew who the audience was, and it wasn't the studio. It wasn't Nixon. It was the viewer on television. Those differences were huge, and they affected history. There are three premises that we need to think about as we think about these basics. And one of them is that we can't think about communication, or we can't communicate outside of the reference to the culture in which we live. Okay? So we need to be aware of that. I want to unpack that a little bit. Do you behave differently in some small levels when you are in your home versus when you're on the streets of New York City? Okay? Of course you do. You do that naturally, and because there's been some learned behavior associated with that. Learning what's appropriate, learning the context. Well, that's true in a broader sense in terms of culture. In an interesting conversation in our business, there's a business called Christian Focus. They publish children's books, and you may have some. They're little readers and a whole bunch of things. We carry a bunch of them in Veritas Press. And I remember having a conversation with the sales rep who had come to America. They're from Northern Scotland, if I didn't say that. And we got to talking about Christian education. And I knew, in the context of the British Isles and Scotland in particular, that things were different there, but I didn't appreciate a difference. Here we are with an understanding of church and state that affects our mentality of things in very deep and significant ways, especially in the context of the kinds of things that we talk about as part of the classical Christian education movement. But here, I'm talking to a guy where it's not illegal, in fact expected, to involve the understanding of the Christian church's influence in history curricularly. I didn't have a context for that. Now, what difference does that make culturally, or how we think in terms of in the practical and specific area of education? Those are significant things. That made me say, whoa, my baseline or my foundation from which I operate when I talk to a group like you would be very different than when I would be in that context. And I don't have all the tools to do that. And I stumbled over myself as I talked to him, and he said, well, we don't have that. We have this. And I thought, I didn't know that. I hadn't thought through that. Cultural context. Those things are important. That is a fairly superficial level of what I'm talking about as I talk about the cultural context that we find ourselves bound in. And we need to be able to kind of step outside ourselves a little bit and be able to understand that and look at that and recognize what's cultural. Missionaries who have gone out into contexts far different than ours have learned that, or they haven't succeeded. And sometimes we have been a bit imperialistic as we've looked at those kinds of things and not really understood them, and so we've maybe been inclined to the temptation of condemning it as not being right while we haven't really thought through the cultural context that doesn't change the essence of the gospel, but it does reshape its communication and its practice in some significant ways. We have another premise that we need to understand, and that's human beings disagree with one another often. We know that. But sometimes we don't get the second part of that, and that is, and for good reasons. Okay? Disagreement sometimes has good reason associated with it that needs to be addressed. Now, I want to say this parenthetically, but importantly, we shouldn't look for disagreement. We don't want to just be different for the sake of being different. And we want to handle difference righteously. I think that if we become successful rhetoricians ourselves and help our students become successful rhetoricians, that we will see difficulties within the Christian community, of which there are many, and they are significant. And if you know anything about my history, you know I've had a lot of them. That we will find that they are dealt with in righteous ways. I don't have any rosy-tinted glasses on that make me believe that we will do away with difference. But I do long for the day that rhetorical quality will increase such that those differences will be handled in better and more righteous ways. It is a very important thing that we accomplish that. Then, as we think in terms of rhetoric and these premises, we need to also recognize that people compose because they want to change the course of events. Now, when I read that, I'd like to take credit for it, and I'm not, because I didn't come up with it, and I think it is a very important thing. I'm going to read it again. People compose, the term compose is a carefully picked term, because they want to change the course of events. Compose is a precursor to communication, and it assumes that it will be communicated. So that's what we're talking about. So when we talk about teaching rhetoric, and we think of it as public speaking, we have missed this very significant qualitative improvement on that start to the process of rhetoric. People compose because they want to change the course of events. That's why rhetoricians do what they do. They want to make things different and better. That's why we start classical Christian schools. That's why we send our children to them. That's why things happen. And we need to recognize that that gives me a definition that says, this is why I think of rhetoric as a capstone. This is why it's significant. This is why it's important. And this is why it should never have been eliminated from the curriculum like it had been in our education. Now, not so naturally, it includes modern tools. And you should note that the ancients would see it that way. One of the things that some people in classical Christian education make the mistake of thinking and doing is not using the tools that they have access to for the logically fallacious reason that they are simply modern tools. How many of you came on a horse? Of course you didn't. There was no place to keep it. We need to recognize that the tools that we have access to would have been coveted by anyone who could have envisioned them in the ancient past. The internet, PowerPoint, I might even say Macintosh computers, or I should say, I guess, Apple, although I'm not an Apple fan. There are all kinds of tools that we need to recognize are part of this process. They are not bad because they're new, just as something isn't bad because it's old. But we need to be careful about that. Now, we need to also recognize what it takes to be expert. And I'm going to get into that in a little bit more practical suggestion a little later, but let me deal with it a little bit. We need to recognize that we need to practice like we've never practiced before. I don't care what it is. If you want to be good at something, you have to work at it. I don't care how gifted you are. Atlanta, or near Atlanta, is the home of Larry Nelson, professional golfer, won the U.S. Open at least once, maybe twice. Larry started playing golf after he got back from Vietnam. He was 21, 22 years old when he first started playing golf. In 3 years, he was on the PGA Tour. I'm going to tell you something, that's not the norm. And I can tell you also, from what I know about him, he's also worked very hard at that point, and he just was very fortunate and made enormous progress. But that is not the norm. Extraordinary and disciplined practice with a high level of criticism from teachers is a necessary ingredient to success in rhetoric. It is, in a word, or in a phrase, hard work. Anything worth doing is going to be. We need to be realistic about what can be accomplished, too. I've noted here, Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods are not just talk. If you knew, and maybe some of you do, what Tiger Woods went through to get to the point of being what is quite possibly the most impressive athlete to have ever lived, you would be astounded at what his routines were when he was younger and what they are now. Why should we think that the mastery of anything at a world-class level is going to be easier in one area than it is in another area? The mastery of rhetoric is going to be enormous hard work. We've already conceded that it's important. The question is how committed and how disciplined are we going to be to make it happen? Now, you and I both know that that's true of everything in life, and there are going to be leaders that are going to rise to the top that are going to accomplish, and it's not going to be for everyone. And I understand that. But by the grace of God, can we have some? Can we have some voices who can say that borrowing trillions of dollars is a bad idea in a way that convinces enough people that we can do something about it? When's it going to happen? I've heard it said that if we don't repent of some of these kinds of things, forgive my soapbox for a moment, if we don't repent of some of these things, that we're going to be inviting God's judgment on us. The same person, when commenting on that, said, "What do you mean, inviting God's judgment? That is God's judgment. That's where we are. The hard work that creates effective and successful rhetoricians is our way away from that and out of that judgment." I have a lot of confidence. I can't tell you what I think we can be righteously and properly executed in the context of classical Christian education the next generation. But it has to do with the hard work that goes into the difficult things. And one of the most difficult things is going to be mastery of rhetoric. I mentioned earlier, I told you I was going to get into some details with regard to rhetoric, and it's simply stated, everything matters. When it comes to rhetoric, everything matters. The words, emotions, character are the logos, pathos, and ethos. The clothes we wear, the perceptions that we give, and these are difficult things. When you get yourself in a difficult skirmish with somebody else, it's a public disagreement, you don't have the luxury, without sinning, of communicating everything you know and everything you think. It has to be measured. It has to be understood in what's right and the context and all those kinds of things. And I want to tell you, I know from firsthand how hard that is. But that's the part and that's the process that we're dealing with when we seek to master rhetoric. And so we don't always get to explain ourselves. Sometimes too much is simply too much. We have biases in the marketplace and otherwise. We've got to recognize those. We've got to get around those. We've got to deal with them. You know, let's talk race for a minute. Are we truly a culture that has no racial biases? Are we a people? Are we individuals that don't? Do we think righteously about these categories? Yeah, it's a pretty easy thing for me to say that I don't have those biases in the context of my own home, but what happens in other contexts? Do we do those kinds of things? How do we deal with them? What are they? Now, I'm not all for, in fact, I'm not at all for the politically correct extreme in the opposite direction, but we've got to know ourselves and deal with those things, deal with them straight up. I remember a funny context. We were involved in church, and I was speaking pretty bluntly at a men's group discussion about some racial issues, and one guy I learned later said to another guy, well, Marlon was really coming across a bit bigoted in some of those things. What was unknown to them that was that the following Sunday, my youngest son and his basketball team would be at our church. He was one of two white kids on the team. Yeah, it's not always what it seems to be. And we need to understand that some of those things get culturally bound and culturally smothered, and some of the rhetorical applications aren't what society tells us they ought to be. We also have weak arguments that sometimes need to be admitted and addressed. If we aren't completely ready for something in the context of a discussion, that's a pretty good place to start, by admitting it. And can be, in and of itself, a rhetorically disarming device for changing the course of events. Well, I want to get practical now for just a moment. I think I have about 10 minutes left. Yeah. And so let's get a little bit practical. I don't want to leave you just in a theoretical category and say, okay, what do we do next? We've got to rethink this and that. So let me give you some practical suggestions. I've done a little bit of thinking about this, and maybe this will just be a catalyst or a head start from where you are at this point, and maybe you're past me and have some additional thoughts as well. But let's talk about addressing rhetoric with regard to strategy. Here's a recommendation. I think we, in the context of our schools, in the context of the education of a classically educated kid, we need to think that 1 year of rhetoric is a necessary minimum for everyone. In that, we're going to get the grammar of rhetoric, the terms and tools. We talked about some of those, logos, pathos, ethos. We'll get to inflection, intonation, those kind of things in just a moment. But that kind of stuff needs to be understood objectively and definitionally. We need to understand those things. Part of mastery involves not just knowing what we're doing, but knowing how we do it. I was interested in somebody who's a great writer doing a writing curriculum for high school for us. We wanted to publish it. I thought this person might be a good guy. And I asked him, he said, let me think about it overnight. Came back the next morning, he said, Marlon, I'm not your guy. And he was appropriately direct with me. He said, I know I'm a great writer. I know it comes to me easily. I know I can do things quickly. And he didn't have to tell me that for me to know that, because the turnaround for things that he's done for us has just been remarkable. And the quality of the work product has probably been unmatched by any of the writers that we've dealt with at Veritas Press. But what he said was, I can't teach it. I don't know how I do it. I just do it. It's gifted this. Well, we need to get past that if we're going to multiply it. Okay? He understood that that was problematic, but it wasn't his business to write a writing curriculum, and he was just telling me I'm the wrong guy. Okay. Different strokes. Not everything's for everybody. No problem. But if we're going to teach people how to be great writers, we better know how to teach them to be great writers. Okay? That's what I'm talking about here. We've got to be able to provide that information. We need to understand the logic of rhetoric, relating and connecting the terms and tools. I think if we look back at the Great Debate example, we see a lot of that. It's very easy to see, you know, 50 years removed now from that, how that happened and the context of that, where Kennedy understood things that Nixon didn't, and it had a change in the course of events in a significant way. And then we have what I'm calling the rhetoric of rhetoric. As much practice and coaching as time allows, and then some. If you want to be good at it, you got to practice it. What do you have to practice? Well, public speaking is part of it. Communicating is part of it. Being on your feet and dealing with it is part of it. And we need to practice it by developing and using principles that can be applied broadly. I use a golf analogy before. I use it for a reason, because I'm a golfer. And I understand these things, and I like them. And if I go out on the practice tee to practice golf, and all I do is hit a slice or a hook, and I keep practicing that slice or a hook, you know what I've learned? How to continue to slice or hook the ball. Practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. So if we want to be good rhetoricians, what we practice needs to be good rhetoric. And that is hard work. And the criticism and the process that goes into it, it's hard on teachers and it's hard on students. It's uncomfortable, it's time consuming, it's laborious, and it's worth it. Second year of rhetoric is something that I think is an important part. You may say, I like what you're saying, I'd like to see it more broadly applied than this, but I think it is at least for the gifted. Now we're going to take those students who really can and make them really able. They have the potential. We're going to help them realize it. Not all of you have the potential to do everything. I gave up my dream of being an NBA player a long time ago. I suspect many of you did as well. We've got to realize, though, that some people are gifted. We need those gifted people to realize those gifts, to be the leaders that they can be, to be the effective communicators, to be the people who are placed by the providence and hand of God in the position to change the course of events, to be there ready, willing, and able when the time comes. And so this second year, I think, has a lot to do with fine-tuned practice, has a lot to do with video feedback. And now, and this is something that I think needs to be thought through more, but I want to throw it out, I think that a lot of what we need is to think in terms of drama. The well-trained actor has dealt with these things far more than the typical classical Christian school rhetoric class has. I wish I could speak more to this, and I wish I could introduce you. I mentioned my son Travis earlier. He's the one in the green shirt and the black horn rims out here working at Veritas Press, and he's going to leave with me right after this talk, so you won't get a chance to talk to him. And Travis is at North Carolina School of the Arts, which is the top five drama school in the country. It's in Winston-Salem. And when he first went to school there, I was aware that what he was doing is, in a very significant sense, was a trade education. I was a little bit concerned about that, and I still am. And so part of our discussion was how he would get, he would add to that education in some other areas that would provide a little bit more balance and rounding, giving him some more options as a career-oriented college graduate. And so that's part of what we discussed and agreed to. But as I've heard from him, what they have done and what they have trained and how they do it, I've realized how much of that and how hard that is and how significant that is in terms of creating not just actors for Broadway or television or the big screen, but in terms of rhetoricians that can communicate unbelievably, and what they do with language and what they do with facial control and expression and those things, it is truly astounding. And we need to recognize that that's a significant part of what we're talking about when we talk about the mastery of rhetoric. Let me just talk about two categories, inflection and intonation. Inflection simply means the upward and downward glide made by the voice when speaking, and refers mainly to single words or syllables of words. This is getting into some pretty serious and technical areas. And I want to tell you something. When it comes to being an expert, you got to get down to the details and master them. I told you that I talked about... Anybody here a golfer? Anybody here have a single-digit handicap? Oh, come on. Sean, close? Okay, what's your handicap? Okay. How many of you know what the angle of your shoulders is at address from left up and right down? Do you think that Tiger Woods knows the answer to that question? Do you think he knows what the angle of his shoulders is in relation to each other at the top of his backswing or somewhere in the middle of a swing? I'm going to tell you something. I know he does. I'm not even close. I know the answer to that. That is the kind of stuff that we're talking about. Technology today has given golfers the ability to do things like that that they didn't have 25 years ago. And that's the kind of stuff that we're talking about. Now, how do we apply it? Do we get caught up in the wrong details and that sort of thing? Of course we do, and we've got to be careful about that. And that's where expertise and really knowing what you're doing comes in. That's the level of stuff that we're talking about as we start talking about things just a little more significant and a little more important than golf, like world events and like Christian culture. We can't simply think of it as this fungible category that feels right and can't be measured and can't be understood. Intonation is the rise and fall in the pitch of voice during speech. As the voice rises and falls, it tends to form intonation patterns or speech tunes. I don't know what those things mean. I can think about them some more. I knew a little bit more about them when I first put them down here because I was reading them in the context of what somebody else who was providing me those definitions was explaining in the book I was getting it from. But have we thought about those things? What are we doing with them? I can tell you they are not substantially communicated in the rhetoric curriculum that I've seen and exists. And there are only two of the categories. Let's move a little faster. We're almost out of time. We've got some other terms that we might talk about. Elocution, that is diction and pronunciation and enunciation. Yeah, the bottom line is, we have just not thought these things were all that important. And so, we haven't succeeded. Because they are important, and we've acted as if they aren't. I hope I've impressed you just a little bit to consider that the devil is in the details are important, and in order to succeed, we can't simply say we're going to succeed without a plan, and the plan always has details associated with it. Posture and body language, extraneous movement and words like and if you listen to this tape, you'll hear me I'm sure that many of you have not ridded yourself by mastery of the and the well and the and the who knows what. I remember having a science teacher, this is hilarious, we counted over 30 times in a class that he used the phrase, and this will sound so bizarre, with it. Now, it was unfortunate because we were laughing at him. We weren't correcting him. We weren't being very gracious. He didn't know what we were doing. But that was ridiculous, I got to tell you. Yeah, even though I must admit that I was sinfully counting with my tally marks as with it. It was ridiculous. We need to wean ourselves out of those things. We need to also recognize the value of humor, measured humor. When is it right? When is it timely? When is it effective? How is it effective? What is my personality in the context of using humor? These things are not so simple as they're a linear process that one-size-fits-all curriculum. We talked about giftedness. We talked about personality. It shouldn't surprise us that the use of devices like humor are going to vary from person to person. And you as instructors and you as administrators and you as students will have to make adjustments on a person-by-person basis. How do you do that? I don't have all the answers. But I know that it's going to be necessary. Because after all, not everybody is going to be able to do the same thing the same way. And we've got to recognize that that's the way things are. That's the way God made them. So what's our goal? I think our goal is to learn to communicate in such a way that the listener is convinced, enjoys the process of being convinced, and acts upon his new conviction. That's the application. That's the goal. That's what we want in the context of the course of changing events. We want to compose because we want to see the course of events change. That's why we're classical Christian educators. That's why we teach rhetoric. That's what we want to see accomplished. And the days are over where we can talk a lot about grammar stage and a lot about dialectic stage and gloss over the rhetoric stage because we don't understand it. Our kids are there now. Some of them are too late. It's already passed. We've got to get it right now. If we don't get this right, we'll spend a considerable time classically educating a child with limited benefit. Thanks.